Okay. There's an interesting event going to happen in Toronto tomorrow, Sunday, April 24th, 3 p.m. Toronto time, Eastern Standard Time, at a church called the Holy Family Parish. Its address is 1372 King Street West. I know Minimax is going to go to it. Anybody else listening in Toronto might be interested in it, but we're going to do something in reaction to this event. It's going to happen, but from Ion's point of view, already happened. And they're going to tackle the topic, the church and technology. The church and technology. A dialogue. The church and technology, a dialogue. And I understand they'll be presenting quotes from Marshall McLuhan, quotes from his Catholic life, and maybe they're going to make a point about the Catholicism of Marshall McLuhan. I don't know what they're going to do. So, hey, Carolyn.
Yeah.
Can you... Okay, so, just a second. So I would like to bring Ion into this conversation, this dialogue on the topic of the church and technology. Ion has said a lot through the years, 33,000 hours, about the church or Christianity and religions and about technology. McLuhan defined technology as beginning with speech or maybe even gesture, decorated gesture. Most people don't think of speech as technology. They say we live in a harassed age of all this technology. Well, that's a definition of technology not based on speech as technology. Something different, or as McLuhan would say, the idea that technologies are these alien invaders that are upsetting human domesticity. So McLuhan said, no, we're going to have to have a different definition of technology. He preferred to think that it was an extension of human beings. So, Ion, I would begin by... are you there, ready to go, Ion?
Sure, we were here already.
Yeah. Now, you can see this small panel tomorrow morning, or no, tomorrow afternoon, 3 p.m., in Toronto at the church. And I was interested if you could see the quotes they're featuring. Are there general themes that you have, can pick up that they are emphasizing in Marshall McLuhan's religious life?
Yes, never as much as what you've already done. And they leave out Mary and Carrie, of course. They get they get a lot of Eric and Andrew because that's what they can do, but there's not much to it. They'd have been better off going to the astronomical tales of the Code of Vaticus or Gratius. That would have been a better topic, but that was what Mark's papa did. So, you know,
who
it would have been better. Mark's daddy did.
Mark Stallman, who studied Ptolemy. He was an expert on Ptolemy. And,
I know, but his daddy wrote the astronomical tables of Codex Vaticanus Gratius.
Is that right? Vaticus something, Tabulus
Gratius.
Gratius.
Astronomical tables of Codex Vaticanus Gratius.
And you're saying Mark Stallman's father wrote that?
Wrote that, yeah.
And you're suggesting Mark would have what? What would he have discovered about the church and technology from his father's writing?
He would have done all that, and that would be a better topic for tomorrow's McLuhanite business.
Okay, so...
well, he's talking about... He has the Nonprofit Center for the Study of Digital Life. Why wouldn't he do that as far as the topical reference? For tomorrow would have been a much brighter.
I'm sure he's going to bring that up. I have no idea how, I don't know Francesco Guardini very well. I spoke to him on the phone a couple of times. Mark, I know pretty well. and we don't know what their motive is or what they're going to present. So, but for in your situation, you can see the quotes that I'm assuming, based on my information preliminary to the event, that they're showing quotes. What aspects of Marshall's quotations are they missing? They forgot to use, or might tell us something more.
They don't understand. Let's do it different. Let's do it different. From the global village to the medium is the message. You have steps in between.
Yep.
There. And they leave out the theory, basic theory of understanding media. And that's because they think everybody knows that. But the few people that are going to, well, who more people are going to hear our version of it than theirs, but we're being glib, aren't we?
Yep.
Didn't mean to do that. But anyhow, they should pick up on the stuff that Marshall McLuhan was trying to purvey, especially if they're going to go to a Catholic church with a Catholic goober and do Catholic talking about whatever it is they're talking about. And you come back to, if they started off with like with the first most famous quote is, I don't necessarily agree with everything that I say.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep.
If they did it that way, then the age of anxiety, which everybody's living in right now, which Marshall was talking about back then, but it didn't have anything to do with Catholicism. They're trying to put a Catholic spin onto the twirl of the spaghetti. We'll do the Italian part of having a nice bolognese.
Yeah, would you say the existential twirl?
Yes, existential twirl, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so there was a state of anxiety that Marshall was discussing, that his Catholicism would not approach appropriately.
It never lands appropriately. That's the problem.
And why is that?
Because art's anything that you can get away with.
Right. Well, we don't know if he said that. And that quote is in his book, but I haven't seen any evidence of where he said it. He may have done it in some obscure article.
Well, you've got the papers. You've got the handwritten. You've got more McLuhan than they've got. You've got more McLuhan than the McLuhans have. You have the McLuhan Foundation, so they better be asking you. That's the rest of the story, but that's another conversation.
Yeah, but you're one of the few people who can see all that I have, so I'm thinking of trying to take what you're saying. What is it about Catholicism that doesn't meet the problems of his time, the 1950s, 60s, and 70s?
Well, if you're going to go that way, then what you're going to lose, some swirl, some shade. Is that what you call shade?
Uh-huh. If I don't include his Catholic statements, I lose
that. Correct. Yeah, if you take the Catholic spin on it, then you're going to turn it around and you need to come up with a statement like this. There are no passengers on spaceship Earth. We are all the crew.
Yeah.
So if you say it that way, Catholicism just left the building.
Why did he play down his private involvement with the Catholic Church in his public performance when he was well known in the 60s?
Well, because it's very simply the same way he explained advertising, Bob.
In the same way he explained advertising. In what way was that?
Oh, it's an environmental striptease for a world of abundance.
Hmm. Now, somebody hasn't brought up a bunch of Wikipedia entries on McLuhan that you're looking at, are you?
They're no good if they are. Well, if they do, we'll put them in right quick. Did you want us to? You need to brush it up. We can do that.
Yeah, you can do that. Okay, so McLuhan said that the Old Testament was anti-technology. He wrote that. New Testament was not anti-technology. Do you agree that the Old Testament, as from your perspective, which is of non-physical, which covers a vast area of human experience, You're quite the generalist, aren't you?
No, Bob, but most of our assumptions have outlived their uselessness.
That's a good one. I like that one. Yeah, I remember that one. That's a good one. But the we've done a lot on Christianity and the Bible, and specifically the Book of Revelations, in detail. And just a simple point, that the cross stands for the chromosome 14 in our genetic makeup. That's an extremely controversial statement. How would anybody, we assume, from a linear view of history, knew anything about our genetic structure 3,000 years ago? But you've explained a lot about that, and we're not going to just have you do a seminar on what we talk about. I want to see how close McLuhan came to what maybe you thought was interesting.
He hit it right on the point. He hit it right on the point. We become what we behold. We shape our tools, and then our tools shape us. You have to take up the cross.
I seem to be, that's an important statement, but I seem to be the only one who noticed on the album version of the Medium is the Massage, they have someone say what you just said, then later, or actually said, I think it's before on the album, but you don't notice it until you hear what you said. And you go back and you hear that they said, what is it? First the tools shape us, then they ape us.
Mm-hmm.
They ape us. And that, to me, gets into simulation.
Well, I guess it's true then. There ain't no grammatical errors in a non-literate society, Bob.
This is not going well. We're just going to have you quoting McLuhan. I'm trying to get your perspective.
I know that's what you wanted. That's what you wanted.
Yeah, we want a lot of that. But I want to say, what does non-physical, which inspired all religions and all prophets and all systems of worship and belief, what do you make about the statement that technology was taboo in the Old Testament? Where would that come from your perspective, if that's true?
The same way Marshall saw it, we drive into the future using only our rear view mirror. That's what all this is, the digital society for a fucked up world comes from, the capacity of seeing where we were going to from behind. Where we were going to from behind. And that's what tomorrow is supposed to be, is a convocation of chit-chat from dead people's perspective of what the future is going to hold, and the divination of McLuhanisms.
Yeah, so you're saying that technology makes people get delayed in their perception. They start referring to the past more.
Correct.
And they miss the present.
If it works, it's obsolete. And that's what they're basing on, is what's working now. That's the same thing that happened with cancel culture. That's the same thing that happened with BLM. That's the same thing that's happened with Antifa. What happened to Antifa all of a sudden? Where did all that come? Once it works, it's obsolete. And that's what's happening here.
Okay, so now McLuhan defined obsolete as it's a lot more prominent. More and more people are engaged in it, but it doesn't have the power of the leading edge that it was when it was the hidden ground, or what he would say, constitutive BLM and that.
That's true. That's true. But here's what you're missing. The point of that, of what he actually said that meant something, is when you have an information overload, when that occurs, pattern recognition is how you determine truth.
Yeah. That's what he said.
Well, you say, yeah. Well, but the point back then, he was talking about why BLM, Black Lives Matter, would have to tear down the Bergdorf Goodman to get the Wonder Bread out of the store. They don't even have Wonder Bread at the Bergdorf Goodman. So why you got to burn down Louis Vuitton to get some soda pop? They ain't got no soda pop at Louis Vuitton. So the point is this is what's happening. The pattern recognition is what they're saying is true. Black Lives Matter, goddammit. That's what you need to know. And we'll burn
That's
down your
pattern.
Black-owned store. And we're going to burn down your black-owned store and prove it.
Well, he said in the 70s, after saying the role of pattern recognition, he calls it the third Copernican Revolution in the 60s. But in the 70s, he said we would become overdoing the cognitive thrills of pattern recognition. And that's 50 years ago. What happened today with pattern recognition? Isn't it being done by technology itself, or what we call the tech body? Isn't that what's doing the pattern recognition for everybody?
Well, what Marshall had to, the answer to that is obviously yes, and to prove the point, Marshall was a firm believer that all media exists to invest our lives with artificial perceptions and arbitrary values.
I remember that.
Pet rock. That's the pet rock motif. Pet rock
Page
motif.
133 of Understanding Media, 5th edition.
By the way, by Schuster and Brackhausen, right?
So, what I'm trying to do the mainstream version of his Catholicism first. There's a lot of esoteric stuff that we've learned talking to Marshall McLuhan, the late Marshall McLuhan. We're talking to something through you, thanks to you. But before we do that, I'm just looking at these general situations. He thought it was very important that Jesus Christ, or Jesus the Christ, whatever the proper nomenclature is, showed us a time at the phonetic alphabet. So his message would be embedded in the alphabet, which was going to be a technology that would stay around, you know, for hundreds of years till you get to the printing press. Is there any interesting perception there by Marshall that the Catholic theologians should acknowledge or think about?
Sure. If you did it in tetrad form, the artifact is seen not to be neutral or passive.
Say it again. If you do it in tetrad form, okay. The artifact, you mean the phonetic alphabet, would seem to be neutral?
No, it's to be not neutral or passive. It's neither.
If you use a tetrad on it.
Correct. That's the media, Bob.
I know, and one of the characteristics of the phonetic alphabet was, because it enhanced the neutral I, it made people passive readers. Not right away, because they were an oral culture and they went through the medieval phase of reading out loud.
and that's where we got the New York Times, isn't it, Bob?
Yeah. Silent subway readers. But
that's when they had the iPhone. That's before technology gave them the tech body's version of the New York Times, which is an iPhone 27 or 11 or 34 or whatever it is today. There's lots of them. That's funny coming to you, the Luddite of the party.
Yeah. So, well, was Jesus thinking of implanting his message in the phonetic alphabet, or he didn't think that way?
Well, see, if you do it the way Jesus, if you do what McLuhan said Jesus would have said, he would have said that Jesus would have said that their power to see environments as they really are. To see, Jesus saw you as perfected, as God-like. And that's what McLuhan was saying. If McLuhan was speaking for Jesus, that would be the position.
That's what Jesus saw.
Would have seen, that, according to McLuhan.
Right.
Perception.
What did the phonetic alphabet do to that perception?
Well, it ripped it all apart and made it rarely well-adjusted.
Right. He did say that in his book, Take Today, he and Barry Nevitt write that Jesus represented the retrieval of tribal values, more of an oral society, oral tactile. Is that anywhere near what Jesus was thinking?
Basically. But then you have to bring in, but you can't talk about Jesus without talking about mediacology. Jesus was the original mediacologist.
Yeah. Now, did Marshall realize that?
He certainly did, because now we're talking about the new media, because with Jesus it was a new religion, a new world that a Jewish man would become the Son of God, where now the new media are not bridges between man and nature, they are nature.
That happens with the printing press, or you just said that happens today?
That's today.
Yeah, that's
There's
today.
There's no difference. But it is today, but then again, there's no difference. At the same time, there's no difference.
Um, How perceptive was Jesus of the fact that all human extensions and expressions and technologies were already existing? Did he get to see that?
Are you talking about how it affects environments or predications of causality?
First of all, did he see all of them, like Nostradamus did?
Yeah.
So, then...
You got it mixed up, Bob. You got it mixed up. They could see it because it's not like a container. It's all processes. They change the content totally. The whole system, see, the killers of Christ, the Jewish Sanhedrin, that wasn't Pilate, the Jewish Sanhedrin, that killed him because he was an existential threat to what they held to be truth. You're not going to come in here. We know God. We know Yahweh. You're not going to come in here and become a stepson of Yahweh. Who the hell you think you are? We built this city. We run this. Get out. And so they make an example of the cross, of coming Jesus coming back into his place of power. Celebrated every year. Every religion celebrates it all. Every year they go on and on and on and on and on and on and on. For the whole position size of the representation of the cross, which is the only chromosome, chromosome 14, that has the rings and arms, the only cross in the chromosomal position, all right, then that's an example that's celebrated every year through Holy Week, Maundy Thursday, Good Friday, the resurrection. So you have to separate yourself from your place of power, and that's why Marshall would embrace the mass, which he did, and he also embraced a lot of other things, but we probably won't go into that right here. But we certainly could. We could give you some bill of particulars that would curl your eyebrows, but that's another confab for another day, obviously. A shout out to Mary McLuhan on that one. That's a good day for that. We shout out to Mary McLuhan and Jerry Brown. So we move along a little bit easier to see that that's what Marshall was trying to say, that everything from first technology comes to a place that it is, you can't grasp it. You have to take a new technology or a first thought, and you have to move it from an enigmatic position of a new way, because they won't ever do it front center, because that's taboo. That's avant-garde. That's a heretic. You're a heretic if you think like Jesus. You see, that's what they call
it. You have said that John of Patmos on the island, when he was doing what became known as the Book of Revelation, he could see New York City as it is today, 2,000 years ago. Could Jesus see the genetic labs of the day?
Yes, and spoke about them. And they even make reference to them in the scriptures. And Ezekiel gave the formula for it. Those dry bones in the Book of Ezekiel. The Catholics do embrace the Old Testament, don't they?
I don't know. Do they embrace? Oh. I don't think so. I think they're based on the New Testament.
No, they're not. No. We were being Bobby.
Is that the Protestants? The Protestants emphasize the New Testament too much?
Yeah, they do. They do more New Testament because they say that Jesus gives you grace so that you can do bad things and get away with it. The Old Testament said if you do bad things, we're going to stone you and your mother for wearing clothes woven of two different fabrics.
Right. So did Jesus pass on his ability to see the genetic structure to his disciples, the 12 famous names, or were they aware of this because it was in the environment anyways as part of the civilization? The genetic labs, or however they analyze the genes of humans. Did the disciples need to be opened up to see that?
Hey, they did. When in the upper room, when all this happened after the... We talk about the Damascus Road a lot and the Emmaus Road a lot. During the Pentecost, 50 days after all this went down, from last Sunday, a week ago or so, whatever it was, that was, the Pentecost is when the upper room occurred, and fire fell on the those in attendance in the upper room. That was that replication of the veil rent for the power coming back to the human, so that they had that capacity to invent a new word. Do you know what the new word was, Bob?
Amen.
Glossolalia.
Yes, glossolalia.
So that's what happened. And so then you use that as this endemic force that changed everything. That you now had power of the Spirit. You were slain in the Spirit. You were swooned in the Spirit outside of yourself.
Wouldn't that be the power of the Word they were discovering through glossolalia?
Maybe, if they knew what it meant.
Well, glossolalia didn't need meaning.
Neither do words today. Bam, there you go.
What? Neither do words today need meaning?
Correct. Yes, we're saying now, the way they're presenting, if they presented their little salon, this is the pre-salon for the post-salon era. This is the pre-salon for the post-salon era. They'd get up and they'd say, very easily, these words are not available. These words are ineffable. We're going to speak ineffable words now because they won't matter. They don't matter.
Right, but you're saying, in terms of pre-salon, the gathering in the upper room, but also tomorrow, us tonight,
well,
and the meeting tomorrow.
It confirms the spatialization of thought, Bob.
What does? What confirms it?
The upper room, the embracing of that capacity of newfound power, this pre-salon, and maybe their post-salon if it's not a total flip-flop or flop-flip as Marshall McLuhan would say, the benefits of an exceptional waste of time.
What is the pre-salon in relation to the room? Is the room the pre-salon?
It's an example of what happens. The same thing happens here that we're doing these details of the place that's going to set the stage for what they're going to do tomorrow.
We're doing
it'll
the upper
up
room.
You're giving the example of how the upper room affects mediacology.
Right. So, yes, because they saw what was going to happen in some form in the upper room.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about what's going to happen tomorrow.
And what happens when you have a sudden leap from hardware to software, Bob? What happens?
Everything tends to become information.
No, it becomes a period of anarchy and collapse.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that part. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what you're experiencing now, especially in those, quote, double quote, developed countries.
Okay, so back to that point, though. Was technology a no-go zone, no-fly zone from the prophets of the Old Testament, from their perspective?
Correct.
It was.
Well, but Bob, you're being very linear. It's not linear. You're being linear. Mm-hmm. Now, it was to be linear was created, but it doesn't really apply because there's never such a thing as sequential thought. It never separates your thought from the action. A knee-jerk
reaction.
Well,
you say it. I prefer you not to say it. Well, you say it. What separates or doesn't separate your thought from your action?
Your linear construct, the way you're describing. It is Bob. Bob's use of this linear progression is not appropriate for sequential thought.
You mean the linear progression of saying there was a New Testament separate from an Old Testament?
Right. Correct. Oh, and then the next step, and then the next step, and the next. They're not like that. They're actually all as one. And if you can do that, now you can have Jack Parr, Jack Benny, and Jack Black all on the same stage and have a very enjoyable show.
Yes. So you have mentioned that the present church and the whole church for the last 2,000 years was the Church of Peter and that Jesus had nothing to do with it. What was Jesus, was he concerned about his work carrying on, that sounds linear. Was he concerned about the resonance of his work?
Well,
as opposed to the church's resonance.
Well, that's what we're going to say. That's the difference between the psychic and the physical.
Hmm. The resonant factor.
Mm-hmm. The extensions of the eye, of the skin, of circuitry, you know.
So did Jesus have a lot more influence on ripping the veil for people to get access to their power? That had more influence on people than anything the Catholic Church did last 2,000 years.
Yes, Babylon has fallen. The Catholic Church has fallen. And if the Catholic Church could do it, they would have started the Hadron Collider today.
Yeah. You said they did or had to do with that? What did you say?
If they could, they would have.
They would have been a CERN. They would have done a CERN. CERN.
They would have started. They would have turned the switch of CERN.
2,000 years ago?
Not today.
They would have engaged the technology, you're saying?
No, they would have flipped the switch on to start CERN, to make the machine go, turn on the dishwasher, turn on the air conditioner, turn on the house lights, turn on CERN. If they were effective and not eviscerated, they would have begun CERN today. It would have given the Catholic Church. It would have given the Catholic Church validity.
Right. Now, that would have begun, say, if they embraced Leonardo da Vinci? Is that what you're saying?
Well, they didn't pay da Vinci, but they embraced him, but they didn't pay him. So I guess they didn't think that much of him.
But you're saying that
the Catholic Church. They is the Catholic Church. We really wish you wouldn't say they.
Right, right. The Catholic Church, are you saying, resisted the technological dynamo of the last 500 years?
No, they just played it for all they could get by with, like art.
But they didn't. But it didn't get to a point of viability at the time of CERN's potential.
Correct. And now Marshall McLuhan would say it all went to hell when they started doing the what do you call that thing? The mass, the polity, the mass itself. No. The abacus. No. The meter. No.
When they left Latin.
And people could understand what they were talking about, and then they realized, like Marshall McLuhan said, they realized then they were all full of shit. They were homey, Bob, so guess what they did? They created a homily that night.
Okay, so there were, according to you, three Jesuses over, say, a period of 1,500 years. There were three of them. There was a Solomon's Temple for each one's life era. And you say the first two never transitioned. They never died. And they're still with us today. But you say the third one, the one we all talk about as the content of Christianity or the icon for it, that he transitioned. But would you add to... did he come back to the body? How did he express his eternity, his immortality, as opposed to the other two who never left their bodies?
You're talking about Jesus's?
The third Jesus left his body. The third Jesus left his body. Did he come back to it?
No, he did not.
Did he ascend, in the way you use the term?
Yes. He did, on the Emmaus Road. That's correct. But now that's laid out clearly in the laws of media, Bob. That's thoroughly laid out.
Can you elaborate a little bit with some content examples?
You have to read the book, Bob. So
I read it. I know the book.
That's it. What? What? You've read a book? Now that
I had some input in it.
Everything, Marshall. That goes against everything Marshall McLuhan ever tried to teach you. Right there.
What did I say or do?
See, it's the new scientific basis.
Oh, that I read it.
Media college. The how media ecology and media studies that are gaugeable It allows prediction. It's exactly what's going on. It's exactly what it was about, Bobby.
Well, I knew that. What are you saying that I, what's my heritage?
You asked us to elaborate. That was all. We did.
Right, and you haven't provided any particulars. You're just making generalities. Now, Eric McLuhan, when he was interviewed as the center was closed and the Toronto Star was being closed in June 1980, he said he specialized in generalisms. And I assume he got that from his father.
So do we.
He specialized in generalisms. So,
well, to be very specific.
Yeah, Pacific.
To be very specific.
So, you're saying there's some generalisms in the laws of media that are very pointed, but that would point to the fact that we've arrived at an area, an atmosphere of anarchy and chaos. That's what the laws of media anticipated?
And we say, look around. Yep.
Well, the book, the laws of media, ends with the statement that we're in a situation where the media sea, the media environments, cannot be measured, cannot be tabulated. You can't make an inventory of them.
Correct.
Is that anarchy? Not
well,
necessarily.
You're mixing up.
If you know how to live in it.
Mixing up. Right. There's the rub. It's the new scientific basis. It's the new. The new scientific.
Yes.
The new.
And
that's the whole point.
Now, Marshall was never considered a successful scientist by the scientific establishment, but would you say that he was on the right track? And laying out the changes that had to be done to traditional science, what had to be added to or toppled?
Herbert Marshall McLuhan, Bob, he embraced the apology of the ridiculousness of the parody of wordsmithing. And he got very good at it in a ridiculous, glib, cliched, archetypal
way. He said the parody of wordsmithing. He celebrated the absurdity of the parody. So what's an example of somebody doing a parody of wordsmithing?
Well, go through the four laws of media, Bob. Four laws of media, Bob.
Yes, but relate to other parts of culture.
Enhancement. What is this? It all applies. It's all the same. Enhancement, obsolescence, retrieval, and flip or reversal.
Right.
There you go.
Now,
so it
the
goes.
Parody...
And that's what they do with everything.
Yes. Who? People? Who's they there? They do that with
everybody.
Everything.
In every situation of every word. The only words written are things that have been thought. Something
right.
I've read is something I've thought.
And this conversation will have a tetrad in its action by the end of it.
It will.
Right?
Well, we'd say it already does.
Okay, so I was going to say you mentioned the, I don't know, the tetrad. Everybody was doing the tetrad. I don't know what. Where were you leading with that?
We were trying to bring up the basic constituency of media laws.
Yeah. So how can you have the parody? So the parody of words. Of wordsmithing, isn't that Manippean satire?
Well, for you, it's Manippean phatic satire. But that's, that's another conversation.
Yeah.
Only you qualify for that missive, Bob.
Yep. But in general, the Manippean, did he study the Manippean historical fact, or was he just a Manippean himself?
No, he just brought up how absurd all these high-minded, so quote, well-educated, informed, progressive theologians and or professors in higher schools of quote, Kiskasay learning came to a place of how ridiculous they are, as best well presented in his feeble attempt at acting in Annie Hall.
That's right. He discussed his fallacy. He said in the 40s in some article that the artist, or at least he, was going to infiltrate decent society, and decent society was in quotes. Now, that was entering into academia, because moving to the software society, the universities would become the new center of bureaucratic control. He called it as the new city, were the universities. And what made him confident that, so he knew to satirize the coming domination of urban life by universities, or the world of experts in the modern media and commentary.
But he never met one. He never met an expert that he would listen to.
Right. So what gave him that insight? Did Tom Easterbrook have that insight? Some of his friends, or was he unique in Winnipeg having that?
No. The work and wisdom of Ezra Pound.
That's right. Ezra Pound had a big influence on him.
With a little disdain for Wyndham Lewis.
Right. No, that's correct. So you're saying he met Lewis first, and that had some influence on him, or reminded him of what he was inclined to favor in his action? What was that influence?
But because he couldn't apply it. He couldn't apply it. Wyndham Lewis gives effects, but never any consequence. It gives the effect, but never a consequence. Marshall was all about the consequence, if you can understand the
consequence. Well, the effects are understood as consequences. Hold it. You know, effects are consequences.
Well, maybe, not according to
Maybe you're
to
trying
Lewis,
to say
though.
Causes. He didn't, Lewis didn't give the causes?
Correct.
For the effects?
Correct.
Okay. Now, when he met Pound.
There was always a scene of a crime. There was always a scene of the crime, but there was never a reason why the crime occurred.
Is that what Pound did that Lewis didn't? He saw the reason?
Pound, through his poetic art, laid the problem before there was an outcome. He told you what was going to happen in a melodic flow of what you call wordy words that gave you what was going to be. So the suspense was always in the beginning of the storyline, never in the last line of the book to know how it's going to go in a Harlequin romance.
Right, so that Lewis emphasized the end of the book and Pound emphasized the beginning. Is that what you're saying?
The structure. Wyndham Lewis never gave structure. Now, T.S. Eliot did, but they weren't in the same Broadway field scope. They weren't in the same scope. They weren't.
Would you say they had different temperaments?
Yes, and different audiences.
Right. So, what was it that, so Pound, he said what was happening. He didn't give the causes. So that leaves Marshall coming up with the causes.
Correct. Well, he didn't come up with the causes. He laid out every detail of why you couldn't achieve a cause, or that the cause you came up with was because of the effect.
Right. That's right. Look at page 137 of Take Today, the bottom of the page, the paragraph at the bottom, page 137. I think that's an important paragraph where he talks about the relationship of effects and causes in at least two different contexts. So, now how does...
Bob, do you have a Wikipedia page that are giving you all these quotes that you're just looking at and reading off now? We're really
You seem pretty smart there.
Now, wait a minute. Are you going to go into the actual Marshall McLuhan papers that you have, or is that for the next fellow?
We'll see. Just see how this goes. See if you can keep up with me.
Bob, you just quoted Marshall McLuhan's famous wedding vows. I like you pretty good. Let's see how this goes.
All right. So, how would we relate the insights he got from Lewis and Pound and Joyce and Eliot to his Catholic condition? Was there an overlay? Or were they representative of pagan culture that he infiltrated as a Catholic, as a Christian?
Well, basically, Marshall could do whatever he wanted to do, any way he wanted to do. You can, now that's all quotable from Marge Stewart. Well documented. Well documented. So,
well, where is Margaret's documentation? What do you mean? And she wrote it out?
She laid it out. Yeah, it's in your, library, second shelf, third row from the left. You know, on the good side.
Right.
On the good side, Bob. On the good side. On the good side. Well laid out. It's actually the organized part of the library. Bob has a fabulous, several fabulous libraries, but they're a little disheveled these days. He gets so busy. He gets so excited. He'll go run, pick up a book and read one page and then lay it down and never touch it again. And he'll run, get another book. He'll read one page and he'll lay it down. And then, out of that, he's been very successful as an accomplished author. He's made three really fine pamphlets. Really fine pamphlets. They're really good. They're barn. Y'all should read them. They're barn burners. You can read them.
Yeah, they're broadsides. They're broadsides.
And he lays out all the Marshall McLuhan theory. The apt and aperture of Herbert Marshall McLuhan in family. It's all.
Right. Okay, but I'm not sure, maybe you answered it, but how did he treat the pagan, the Gnostic or something? He called this account a Gnostic. Eliot's a Gnostic. Gnostics. How did he relate that to his Thomism?
We're going to finish it.
Okay.
So he embraced Catholicism because he could still go do whatever the fuck he wanted to do, which he did. Ask Corinne. He could do anything he wanted to do, and he did, and he did.
You mean, you say because he embraced Catholicism, he had permission?
No. He used Catholicism, or attending Mass, and his Hail Marys full of shit, something, and the rotaries, reading the rotary, rolling the bowl, the stations of the crisscross, you gotta do those. And then you go through this whole process of being forgiven by a pedophile. Most of the priests were in those days. So, I mean, if I'm gonna get absolution, I wanna get it from a pedophile for pizza. So then what happens is you get forgiveness that allowed him the tenacity or capacity, as it were, to absolutely make fun of the very words that were the tenets of the Catholic faith.
That's right. The
absolution.
What the critics of Marshall McLuhan would say, this is how they would translate what you're talking about. They'd say, well, it's all fine and dandy to know everything and to have a faith and then go around and make everybody else who's not just an average human who's a bit nebulous about what they're doing and make fun of them because you're pretty certain he was pretty certain with his Catholic understanding. Is that what, that's the vulgar way of looking at what he's doing. You're saying that he could engage all parts of society with a freedom because of what? What was the Catholic part that gave him that?
Oh, it was all becomes of answer, ask, and then those capacities, as long as you fit, or as you say, I don't care if it rains or freezes, as long as I got a plastic Jesus sitting on the dashboard of my car, I'll be okay. See? Or the basic tenet from the papacy is, would be a question like this. What do you call an illegally parked frog, Bob?
Don't know.
Toad.
Toad away?
Now that's good. Now that's the way the Catholic Church, the Catholic Church, the papacy, would make that a tenet that cardinals would embrace thoroughly. The blessed toad. The blessed toad one. The toad.
Mm-hmm. Right. Marshall said that, he quoted some part of the Bible that said, if there are two people there in my name, quoting Jesus, then there is the church. I don't know if he used the word church, but there I am. So did Marshall understand that the chair of Peter was not fulfilling the...
Not a chair, it's a seat. Not a chair, it's a seat.
The seat of Peter... was something that he didn't have respect for? Since he said, you can see the two people.
Peter didn't.
Who?
He was quoting that Peter. Marshall McLuhan was quoting that Peter didn't have respect for the church.
Ah, okay. So, was Marshall's understanding of what hijacked Christianity through the church? What did he think of that? Or
the words? The words, if they'd have kept it in Latin, and kept everybody young, dumb, and full of cum, they wouldn't have had all this trouble. You wouldn't have known it. You wouldn't even have known it was a sin that you needed forgiveness for. Absolution.
Okay, so he was
all the way for... That goes all the way, though. No, you're not going to get away with that. It goes all the way back to what the printing press was for. To print indulgences so you could save dead people. So the dead people that were bad, that didn't get absolution, wouldn't have to stay in hell, purgatory.
Right.
So that's the whole point.
So he looked at the... within the institutions, I'll say this. So in his notes that I went through when I did the archives in his archives for Corinne in December 1980, there was a piece of paper I found, and he said, he wrote, "I always identify with the underdog." Then he said that's French Canada, the American South, and the Catholics, I guess. I don't know if he said Catholic Church. So you have French Canadians, American South, where his wife came from, and the Catholics. Was he putting on society and adversarial, or what he would call anti-environment, by picking the minorities? That was all his strategy to appear in public life, and that had nothing to do with his faith or his own sense of power, or it did. Like, how close is his public performance to how he thought a Catholic or a Christian should act?
He didn't. He didn't say Christian. He was Catholic. He didn't acknowledge Christians. He didn't embrace Catholics.
Why would that be?
The Protestant. Because he wasn't fond of Her Majesty's
religion. See. The Christians includes everybody else. He's not doing that.
He was, so for God's sake, he just barely survived the coach house, Bob. They probably would have hung him for treason had he hung around.
So, what does the magisterium, I don't know how you define it, what you would say it is, but the magisterium, how does that relate to the answer you just gave? He does not accept the Christians, he accepts Catholics. How does the magisterium fit into the action of being a Catholic?
Oh, my God. Now you're getting into McEwen now.
You mean the guy he quoted in his PhD a lot? Or Rod McEwen, the poet?
Both.
Both? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Too much impetus, Bob. Too much impetus.
What is? To say the word magisterium?
Yeah.
Okay. How did the seat of Peter misuse the idea of the magisterium, if they did?
The shifting tides of understanding the level of mediocology that the church was trying to purport. See, they weren't trying to save anybody. They were trying to develop a non-Gnostic out, so that the stupid sinners could have an access to Christ, the power of Christ.
You said a non-Gnostic bout, it sounded like you said. Bout. It was B-O-U-T? A non-Gnostic fight? Okay.
Yeah, it is. So that because of the Catholic Church, all they're supposed to do is give you access to the body and the blood of Christ.
Right.
That's a sacrament. That's all they're supposed to do. They can't save you. Fuck you. If you don't ask for forgiveness, you're not going to make it no way. I don't know what happens to you. It's not pretty. Whatever that means, it's not pretty. And then you come along, so it's like, oh, okay, so if I participate in this, and it's supposed to be into a Peterbilt. A Peterbilt, not the truck, but a Peterbilt is in the church, into a nice, healthy Peterbilt full of diesel, but at least it'd have a lot of value if it was a a full Peterbilt of diesel. It'd be valuable. But what happened is they became the system. They became the anti-God, God. They became the representation for the church, for the anti-God. Because if you can't have God, you have to have the church. You're not available for God. You have to be. And that's why they even paint the Pope a certain way, that he's God's representative on the earth.
Mm. Hey, he's not God. Now we get, or he's not a God?
No. Now, they're really careful how they go, because these, you're not supposed to worship all these graven images that they fill their cathedrals with. Mm. Oh, wait, sorry, we messed that up. They kind of do worship the Mary Mother,
but if anybody's re-listening to this, they go back to that sentence you said 3 minutes ago about the anti-Gnostic, non-Gnostic bout. You were describing the seat of Peter. That bout is not what Jesus was engaging, or was he?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all.
Not at all.
Jesus, the only way Jesus can get in the Catholic Church is in an obelisk.
Well, people would, they used to...
Dominus, Datus, Odo, Dominus, Redus, Edo. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, they used to talk about, a lot of people didn't have respect for the churches in the 20th century as the century unfolded.
Why?
Maybe due to...
Why? Why? Why?
Because there were new gods, new idols in the software world.
Because of mediacology, which is exactly what Marshall McLuhan said.
Well, it sounds like a cause
when
you say mediacology.
You take this on, and you wear it, and you find out that the emperor has on no clothes.
Right. But
this is from doubtless miscontent. Doubtless miscontent.
We'll see that the emperor has no clothes.
Correct. But you would never notice unless you were able to try those clothes on for yourself. And the Catholic Church would never allow you in their robes. Unless you're prepubescent. Then they would discuss it.
Right. So a lot of citizens felt that they saw through the institutions. And then they say, Jesus, if he came back, he wouldn't join any of these churches.
But
often the non-religious would say that. What would have Jesus have done? Or he's always been here anyways. What has Jesus been doing in relation to the work of Peter and the seed of Peter?
They were trying to win over Robert Hutchins, Bob.
That's what McLuhan attempted to do in 1946. Yes, when he went to the University of Chicago.
Right. That's what he was trying to do, and that's what Jesus was trying to do, and that's what the church was trying to do. And they all fell flat on their feet.
Well, you just said that Jesus was doing the same thing as the church?
Of course. That's exactly what the Sanhedrin killed him for.
Well, you mean he was a politician?
Anyway. Bob. He took up with a Samaritan woman at the well. He made an eye salve out of his fiddle, and he saved Laman. He took Naaman and put him in the water. He turned water, perfectly good wine, into very vulgar water. He did all these miracles and wonders that everybody has the capacity and power to do. But the Jewish Sanhedrin says, oh, no, you're not going to tear up our church, quote. All right, then fast forward, then you got Peter, the next people coming against the Catholic Church, and they come over, oh, you're not going to turn or tear up our church. And you go into the next level, and next tier, now all of a sudden there's no church. And so now all that you're left with is the polity of God. Polity of God, which is the only thing that ever worked anyway. That's the reason we said that church, all quote church, Catholic Church is what you're talking about here, would not receive Jesus. Jesus Christ could never be the Pope.
Right.
That's a slap in the face, then. Well, you say right, but that's a slap in the face.
Right, but he wasn't part of that church. But would Jesus today would go around doing the inventory you just said, you know, healing the sick and all these different things that he did in his ministry. He continued doing that.
He'd probably open a trap house.
A what house?
Trap house.
What's that? T-R-A-P?
You can Google it, Bob.
Google that,
urban definition. Under urban definition. Make sure you do the urban definition. That'll help.
The Urban Dictionary. Right. Okay. Are many citizens in the 20th and 21st century living lives of the same, quote, intensity or success as Jesus lived his life supposedly 2,000 years ago?
Yes, they are, Bob, but like Marshall McLuhan pointed out, now you have to do it without the benefit of being able to access my three sons.
Why not? That's available.
They're not a quick kid. Okay, what page do you get to watch My Three Sons, Bob?
I don't know what page, but it's available in somebody's media archive. YouTube.
Okay. So now, just like the Catholic Church, you have to depend on someone else to access the information for you. And that's what the Catholic Church was trying to present, and that's what Marshall McLuhan tore up. He was a good Catholic, which is an oxymoron in and of itself. Being a good Catholic is like being a good lawyer. We don't hold much store for either of them, only because all of them leave you in the dark. Even in death, a church that presents death for Pete's sake. What kind of church would you join that guaranteed you to die? So, then you can't even die without a priest coming to give you last rites.
Okay. George Thompson, who was Marshall McLuhan's aide for like 10 years, so he got to know Marshall pretty good. He knew him many decades before. He worked for Marshall McLuhan in the early 70s. He told me that Marshall was not a Catholic.
Right.
And a little later, I probably asked him to explain that. He said, well, you line up McLuhan with 1,000 Catholics, and he's not like any of them. What was George seeing? He may not have defined it correctly, but what was he seeing?
The glorious, he was seeing how the twinkle in his eye of how much he enjoyed his darling children.
Okay. That all? That determined that he was not a Catholic?
I don't know. That may be the best thing that described him as a Catholic, though. I guess if you're a priest, huh? That was cheeky. No, let's say it this way. That ramification of every other aspect, he was always digging, trying to come up with some position that he could support the ridiculousness that people were embracing as topical. That's why he spent days speaking about a remote control in the days when they just barely invented remote controls. Boy, what would he do if he had a Siri or an Alexa in that window? That'd be pretty scary, wouldn't it?
Right. So you're saying that his modern form of poetry was to come up with verbal utterances to shake up the citizen every day. He didn't write a poem and go read it at a poetry society or something. He considered everything he was doing daily as a teacher and pretending to be a professor and all that stuff that he was putting on was his form spiritual warfare.
Sounds like Lewis Carroll now, Bob.
Doesn't it sound like Wyndham Lewis?
Lewis Carroll more.
Lewis Carroll.
He was trying to come up with a conclusion. There is no conclusion. Marshall couldn't come up with a conclusion, so he just sort of went with it. So he'd go to Mass, get his jihad, and then he'd move on down the line.
And what was that about the Lewis Carroll? He knew there was no conclusion?
Correct. And he lived in those tenets that actually made a conclusion. So you ended up without us down the wormhole.
Right.
Or through the
looking
glass.
And, you know, he ended cultures or business. What?
Through the looking glass.
Yes. Marshall ended culture
that's
their business.
That's the one nobody talks. That's the one that nobody talks about, you know.
That phrase, through the looking glass?
Book. That book.
That book. He ends culture's our business with the statement, there is no finish line. That's the most profound statement he could make in the whole book. So it got
so
to be the final statement.
Well, when we get it rewrote, we'll let you know thoroughly.
Okay. So I would like to...
Did you hear that?
Yeah, when you get it rewrote, you'll let me know.
That's what Marshall McLuhan would have said, is that you're putting this on and you don't know what it tastes like until you try it on. And then when you try it on, if you really try it on, you're immediately going to not like it, no matter what.
So the way Marshall engaged so many parts of society were the average bourgeois Catholic, bourgeois Protestant, bourgeois Hindu, bourgeois Buddhist, think that he was rather secular,
or at least Alan Z.
What's that, Alan Z?
Oh, for Pete's sake, Bob, you're pointing out Marshall McLuhan's cause and effect. Come on now, you got it. Move on.
Alan Z, who's that?
Yeah, en français.
I don't know.
Move on.
Who's that? Move. Point out is Alan Z.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Oh, it counts as that's French for move on.
Right, that's what we said. Bob is
right.
So much fun. See, Bob makes this cause and effect interesting even to the simple people. That's what Bob does. Bob makes you feel better. The simple folks, the non-Catholics can even embrace this. When Bob gets through it, you don't have to be special. You don't have to read and write and all that, all this. You don't have to conjugate a single verb with Bob. It's great. He's with everybody. It's good. The real easy ones. And he can deal with the smart ones, but he can just tell you how, they'll figure out how not smart they are when Bob gets through with them. But up until that point, he raises every boat in the bay. Yep, that's our
yes,
Bob.
Yes. Yep.
You can step on the back of Bob if you need a little lift me up. A little lift me up, just get on Bob's back. It's a good day.
Right. Now, there's a new factor in engaging non-physical is something called the tech body, which has intervened in our human communication processes, including these kind of, quote, channelings or access to non-physical. Has much of what we've heard come out of your mouth, has that been all ion, or has there been some tech body in there?
No, but you really should consider reading The Mechanical Bride.
Is that ion or the tech body saying that?
That's us.
Yeah, us is both of you, tech body and ion.
Oh. Oh, okay.
But you're saying ion. Okay, so okay. I was wondering if it would be possible to bring Marshall in and have him comment on what you've said, what I've said, and what
we've basically been doing that all night alone already.
I get that. But let's bring in his some. You've been citing his aphorisms, his writings, his scientific statements, his artistic statements. What about
his
personal
words,
reaction?
His wordy words. He wears.
No,
wordy
let me
words.
Put it this way. He told me through you. Back in about 2010, when Douglas Copeland's book came out, written on Marshall McLuhan, it angered Marshall. It was absurd, the book, and too much emphasis
correct.
On some kind of autism. I'm wondering how Marshall would react to the performance tomorrow by Mark Stallman and Francesca Guardini. What would he, if he had a chance to be heard, what would he say?
The same
Let's
thing.
Have him, no, I don't, I'm not asking you what he would say. I'm asking him to speak.
How
That'd be
in
done.
The world could you... okay, are you ready?
Yeah, this is Marshall.
How in the world could you possibly come together in some concave to have a discussion of how this world parallels the world we know it's already been? that you're arguing from the standpoint or trying to make known conditions that there's no way you can have a predicated outcome of or for. So the best you're going to do is confound your own disillusionment.
I get that. That's pretty accurate. So what would he what would you, Marshall, suggest be an alternative tactic or strategy to counter what you just warned us about?
After thoughtful consideration, we consider that you should take up facial book. It would be an equal waste of time.
I see. Well, how would you suggest using our time, Marshall?
Oh, that's easy. That's easy. There's a new thing that's been invented. It's better than the remote control. It's called a TikTok.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you should just consider. You should consider. It's got the whole wide world in 30 seconds or less. That's why there's no attention span. 30 seconds or less. And you'll spend 8 hours a day watching 30 seconds at a time. Now, there's some mediacology.
Well, the way you use mediacology, yeah, says there's a mediacology. How would you define mediacology? It sounds odd.
Oh,
mediacology is more verb than a noun. And you're presenting it as a noun.
It is a noun. It is a noun. If you do it right. It is a noun if you do it right.
Yeah.
It's not an, or it can be an adverb like a mediacological event.
Yeah.
Okay, you can do that. You can do that. Or mediacological, speaking mediacologically, which gets to be ridiculous. That's the reason we use it as a noun. From the event of having a thing demand or drive the narrative. TikToks drive the narrative, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. You're not wearing a TikTok. TikTok is wearing you. So you push a button. You're watching TikToks, but then you push one little button. Something interesting comes on. And then they always find the people that are morbidly obese, that have no teeth, and they most certainly have never had their hair done ever one time. Push a button and start telling about grand, wonderful things that they saw at the Piggly Wiggly, and how exciting it was, and how the Patriots is coming to whoop everybody's ass, and how the dog, Sadie the dog, can sit up there and sing and talk and tell you what her fluffy mother did, and what the problems of the world is, and how it's solved, and then how Fat Betty fell off the John Deere tractor, and then step by step by step. Then you can say these things, so you become that media event, which is mediological.
Yeah.
What we're saying. And so, therefore, you become that thing. So TikTok is this marvelous thing. Why? Because people are in it. They're captured in it. So it's exactly what he warned in the Gutenberg.
Well, that's you. What you warned, Marshall. I'm trying to emphasize this is Marshall. Marshall's saying what
we
Marshall
did.
Warned.
We did.
Okay. You did. You, Marshall, did that. Yes.
How many times have we spoke of ourselves in the third person, for Pete's sake?
Yes, you have, many times. So,
no.
That would be the difference between Marsh McLuhan and Herbert Marsh McLuhan.
Correct.
Marsh McLuhan was the object that was the third person generation. You say
oh,
that?
Oh, now Bob's channeling Corinne now. Oh, this is going to get good.
Yes. Yeah, I could beat Corinne. Marshall, yes, he was a family man, but he loved the idea of the family more than engage the family.
The actual engagement of it. Well, it's just overrated. It's overrated. You can't depend on it, so it's more than less a good waste of time.
But there are benefits. Since I have you here, Marshall, I used to talk to you through the Michael Blake Reed. He channeled the Evergreens, and I used to speak to you through them. And I once asked who had an influence on you. I don't know if I said that no one ever heard of, but something like that. And you said Somerville. And I said, I don't know that name. And you probably said, look it up. I've never found it. I don't know if I have exactly the name that was said to me, 35 years ago through the Evergreens. But who can you tell me who you were referring to? Who was Somerville?
It was a college friend.
Right. And what was why was that person so influential? What area was that influence in?
Well, it's a long story, so here we go. We like long stories. They don't ever take very long, though, do they?
No. Not with you. Go ahead.
We have to get to the point of the point. Okay. It was a
long... Yeah, do an aphorism on it. Yeah, you're an aphorism.
It was a long...
Aphoristic.
Okay. It was a long, cold winter in the Bowery Banks of Canada. And
okay.
There was a friend. And there was a friend with Walter Ong. There's Peter Linner.
Yeah.
And Mr. My dear friend was also from Edmonton. And what happened is that we got to be close, and we got each other. And he was so ridiculous that it was beyond regard. And what it did was it made me see a fast-paced, engaging, brainy, fun way to blast the capacity that stretched human, however narcissistic, reality. And so, therefore, you become above it all by being ridiculous and silly in spite of it all. And so that was a huge thing that changed. And we were together all the way through the University of Manitoba.
Right, and so you mean he the person is maybe funnier than you, and could talk fast.
Maybe. But see,
well, some of that
we were trying to get him to come to Cambridge, but he thought I was just above him, so it didn't work
out. Right. So, but you're saying that the rapidity of interacting with him, more so than Tom Easterbrook, which is the same period, was, what do you say, it's the cat's meow. It's what he liked to do, or what he learned to like to do, or what he didn't know he liked to do until he started doing it with this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And
correct.
That was...
Now, we met up again in Windsor at the Assumption University, and that was fun, but it only lasted like the summer. Because then it was like, no, then we was like, this is ridiculous. This is as ridiculous as we knew it to be.
Right. So, sounds like a couple of friends I've had. I understand. Acquaintances.
Friends.
Yeah.
Friends. Now, talk about topical. This is topical. Tell us now, let's take this opportunity to have a little break. We'd like to thank the Marshall McLuhan Foundation for sponsoring this program this hour. We will give our free shout-out to the Marshall McLuhan Foundation and the McLuhan Foundation as well.
Now, this is Marshall talking or Ion?
Both.
Okay.
So we'd like you now to go into who your quote-unquote friends are, and please supply references.
Well, there was... two other people I knew in the early days that were megalomaniacs. They thought that they were candidates for the second coming. So I joined in that.
You have references, though, right? And just not your babblings. You know, you do that a lot.
One was, his nickname was Flaps, and the other guy was named Steve. And then there was me, and I engaged this... fracas to see who would be the second coming, who would act it out. Flaps, you know how he did it?
Oh.
You know how he became the second, or tried to become the second coming? He went to a university and took nothing but theology courses.
Nice.
He didn't take any other courses, just all theology. That's what he thought would lead him to the second coming position, of being the second coming. Now,
He was trying to compound the mythic structure of modern Western culture.
Ah, very good. Yes, that's cool. Then Steve took a different approach. He avoided university and became a working man. And as long as he could play his guitar and do music, he thought that was the route to slack and maybe of some significance. But he was rather indifferent to being the second coming. So,
his aspect was he was trying to invent the alphabet without being able to read or write, which intensified that intensification of the visual sense in his musical repose set a priority higher than, say, higher learning. So
yes.
The visual sense of hearing.
Yes, excellent.
Mm-hmm.
And then my strategy was find a good friend. And I found one, Dr. Dean. Her name was Carolyn back then. So I figured, well, she might help the second coming.
And understanding media, that's where you'd have to say God is dead, isn't it, Bob?
Yes, yes. Carolyn was alive, God was dead. So I took the strategy of engaging someone who was very good at being a megalomaniac and not making it so obvious. Something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Much like the way Sidney Powell today describes her youth. That was Carolyn.
Oh,
look up Sidney Powell.
Did she have a French commode?
Did you, Carolyn? You have a French commode? No, Sidney has that.
Sidney Powell.
Yeah, no.
Sidney
yeah,
Powell.
Sidney has that, but Carolyn doesn't. No. Carolyn just had her ability to enjoy my humor. That's all she had.
Oh, now Bob's going to start. Now Bob's going to interrupt the program and tell you how he really did the Gersten lecture series.
Yeah, he's quoting what McLuhan did back about 1967. That's right.
71, Bob. Come on, don't miss your date.
He did other lectures in 67.
That was the Marfleet lectures, Bob. Come on now.
That's right, the Marfleet lectures. Well,
uh-huh.
Okay. Well, you would know, Marshall, what you did. So Marshall.
Well, we're not sure. Because, see, that's why Bob is the esoteric. There's that word again. Bob is the esoteric ramification of how the little simple people can make it. Because he can just say anything and get away with it. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It confounds the really smart people because they're fighting fire trying to get three people to show up to their salon, and Bob's already selling out already for no money. He sells his stuff for no money, and he's got sales. He's back-ordered for months. He doesn't seem to charge for his stuff, and he's back-ordered for months. So,
okay, Marshall.
So he'll show you. Bob is the only person here that y'all going to listen to lately that has the innate capacity to cliche an archetype.
Ooh, nice one. So, Marshall, by being a Catholic, that gave you an alibi for exploring all kinds of risky areas?
Well,
is that what I am getting at?
We use Wilfred Watson to be our fall guy.
Ah, that's right. I was just thinking of him. I'm going to bring him up. Didn't you use Ralph Baldwin, Bernie Muller time, Ted Carpenter? You use everybody?
No. Most of those jackballs from Fordham University for sure. They didn't do any much.
That's who you use? The jackballs from Fordham?
Mostly.
Yeah.
Mostly.
Okay, well, I don't know if he was the head of Fordham when you were there in 67, but it was the brother of Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA in the 50s.
No, you're talking about the Schweitzer chair, Bob. It's not that. It's an honorary thing.
No. Yeah, the Schweitzer chair is what Fordham gave him, the alibi for having him there. But look up Carolyn, Alan Dulles. Get the brother's name. See when he was at Fordham. Maybe that should come up. Look up Alan Dulles. He'll show his brother's name. Then you see when he...
And look up... And Harley Parker, don't forget him.
Well, okay. When I had access to the archives, I saw that Joe Keogh, who I met back in the 70s, K-E-O-G-H, was a student of Marshall's in the late 50s and helped do the index to Gutenberg Galaxy. He was a early version of Derek de Kerckhoff, say, or Bob Logan. He was the student hanging around Marshall. I remember Mary saying, I brought up Joe Keyes. Oh, my God, that guy was at our home too much, way too much. Anyways, he seems to have the most correspondence with you, Marshall, in the letters that are gathered in the archives. Was there a special relationship with him?
Why was he said more connected to Jerome.
To Jerome? You mean the...
Jerome Agile.
The guy who created, who organized the production of the Mediumism Massage. And Quentin Fiore did the work.
War and Peace.
And that too. Those two books. You're saying Joe Keough was more involved with Jerome? Or Jerome was more? What are you saying here?
But what's the difference? How do you know? Was he more friendly with Carolyn, or was Carolyn more friendly with he? What's the difference, Bob?
Did you say Carol? Kelly?
Carol. You know your acquaintance, Dr. Carolyn Dean?
You've known her
for a few days.
You're asking
now.
If Joe was more familiar with Carolyn than Jerome?
No, we were using words to point out how ridiculous it was to see which one was more befriending of the other friend that they each were friends with, and which used the other one's friendship more to the other's friendship advantage. It's circular.
Well, why did Joe Keough write so many letters?
Oh, they were trying to keep up with the spastic situation that day.
Did you finish the sentence? Spastic situation that they, or did you say something else?
That obeyed.
Obey?
Obeyed.
You obey?
Yeah. There's a spastic
situation.
Oh,
evade.
They obeyed it.
What's he saying, Carol?
Evade?
The spastic situation to evade.
That they had to evade. So that made static communion chatter of what we had to overcome and not talk about. So what we had to have a salon to talk about what we're not supposed to be talking about. Okay, good.
Okay, here it is. No dates, tried three places, but he taught and resided at Fordham University. But look at these words.
He doesn't say he's president?
No, taught and resided.
What's his name?
Oh, no, that's about a son, Avery Dulles.
Right. Look at this. Look at the father, the brother of Alan Dulles.
Yeah, John Foster Dulles, 1888. But it just says the son did the Fordham.
Look, there's John Foster, there's Alan, and then there should be a third brother. Do I have to look this up myself?
Yeah. Go ahead.
What? Bob's taking action? Well, now that goes against every monicum of decency we've experienced with Bob so far, that's for sure.
All right, so you look down under family.
Come on, Bob. Cast off those shackles of doubt and disdain. You can do this. You can do this.
He had a sister. Jeez, I don't know. One of five children, Minister, 1893, and his wife. So he had a brother, John, sister Eleanor, uncle. Dulles was uncle to Catholic convert Avery Dulles, a Jesuit priest and cardinal of the Catholic Church who taught theology at Fordham. Yeah, see, that's later, 88, that's his son. So there doesn't seem to be a third brother. So somebody misinformed me about that. Okay, sorry, that's a wonderful digression, typical of a Monday night seminar at the Coach House. So I'm asking Marshall... what he learned from with a man we're calling Somerville, was that the most important thing he learned in human relationships, as opposed to what he learned from Ted Carpenter?
I never learned anything from Ted Carpenter.
What about Felix Giovanelli?
Well, Giovanelli, you learned what not to do by example. You know what not to do by example.
Let's ask you, what did you learn from Wyndham Lewis as opposed to what you learned from Ezra Pound?
Oh, the distance, how far you can go. You go from the inane to the absurd. And so what Wyndham Lewis did is she laid out all the cards so you could clearly see everything being presented, and then he would make a mystery of it. When everything was clearly laid out that everyone could attain, every aspect of all the constructs that he would, in the farthest stretch, could even be imagined, was all laid out there in front of everybody, and then he would make that a mystery.
I got that. That's Lewis. So what did Pound do?
Pound laid out the details, gave you every detail without giving you any example, without giving you any construct. It was all ethereal. Then you could make it into whatever story you wanted it to make. They became just abject words that you could then parody into your own life sickle, not cycle, sickle, because it's all cyclical, you see. So you come back, that's the rearview mirror aspect. But he at least gave you a chance through the rearview mirror to catch a glimpse of your future.
Okay. Now, how was Lewis different from that? You already stated, but I'm not sure I remember.
Lewis told you everything and then made it a mystery. Pound gave you the mystery without the solution.
Okay. But you said Pound did the particulars, or
yeah,
and Lewis did the details. I don't know which way you had it.
Lewis was profound in telling you everything you need to know, then couldn't give you the solution. Ezra Pound didn't tell you much about it, but always solved the problem. When you read these short little cryptic poems from Ezra Pound, it was solved. But you could take his formula and apply it to your ex-wife, compare it to your illegitimate children, to your relationship with your priest at your local domicile, and then that could be solved. You could apply Ezra Pound's words to whatever the situation is. A drug addiction, an absinthe problem. Mm-hmm.
So Lewis failed to come up with a solution. But Pound pretended he had the solution, and the solution was a mystery. Always a mystery.
He never gave you the outcome. Told you every detail of it. Every detail of it, but with no conclusion.
Well, that's similar to Lewis not coming up with a solution.
Similar. No, but Ezra Pound gave the solution without the details.
And Lewis gave you the details without the solution.
Correct. You couldn't achieve it. That's why it became a bit profound, because it was very, the words were very, Wyndham Lewis was very profound in his ability to confound you by trying to be straightforward, but he never he never knew anything. You knew some words, but it didn't benefit your life or liberty in any degree or perfunctory value.
Yes, and so I'm reading right now, Self-Condemned, Wyndham Lewis's novel, 1954, and it's about his stay in North America during World War II, and that's when he met Marshall, and Marshall McLuhan is a character in the novel. His name is Professor Ian McKenzie. Marshall, what did you think of the portrait of you? Don Thiel told me you were very proud of being in the book. Is that accurate?
Well, yes, because there was no conclusion.
Yeah, that's right.
You see, with no conclusion, my life all of a sudden had a value. Someone else gave it.
Yeah. So he described you as a Scot who just arrived in Canada, knew a bit about the war scene, the first couple of years of the war, 39 to 41, and that actually is the period, half of it, that you and Corinne were in London. Cambridge, what did you make of the coming attacks by the Nazis? What was your experience in Cambridge? That would be January, February, March, April, 1940. I think that's before the bombing of the city, right?
It was expected. It was expected. It was presented. It was all but roped.
Well, did it make you want to get the hell back to North America, or were you a brave citizen?
No.
Ready to die?
It's not ready to die. It wasn't even about that. It was a little different time. It was, you had, things are instant today. Things weren't instant in those days. You had windows, weeks to know that this terrible thing was going to occur. You'd already gotten telegrams, telexes. You already had information, you know, that this was imminent. And so the bulge didn't have to be all the problem of Normandy. You knew it was coming.
Right. So that you'll emphasize a line in Finnegan's, I don't know if it's in Finnegan's Wake or Ulysses, but it's it says, living as if every move were your next. Is that the way it would be in, when you were at Cambridge with things coming?
Yeah.
Every move was your next?
Yes, but the only reason we left is because we couldn't mark our bathtub to have to know how much water we could have in the tub.
That's why you left.
Correct.
Why? Because you got in serious trouble not being able to mark it?
No, Bob. We're pointing out that the shortage of water is a good enough reason to leave a country.
Oh.
You should know that.
Okay. Yes. So, were you a Catholic marshal?
Formally.
You're alive here.
Formally.
Formally. F-O-R-M-A-L-L-Y. Formality. Formal.
You
formally?
Used to be.
Used
As in
to be.
A former life.
Did you drop the Catholicism by the 70s? Because I understand you started doing yoga.
We just sort of let it lay. We let it lay because it's ridiculous. And when they changed the rules and made it so that everybody could be a Catholic, it lost all the flavor.
That's the Vatican effect, Vatican II. Right.
Correct.
So that is when you went public. Vatican II is the early 60s. You're starting to go into public with Howard Gossage's support in 65, 67. You've entered the arena, the pagan arena. Is that because you were a bit more relaxed about the Catholic discipline? Dropped it a bit?
Correct. Correct. Otherwise, how many Catholics you know star get their angle in their business world for writing an article for Playboy magazine?
Right. That most people who experience you through those secular pagan media didn't know you were Catholic and were surprised later if you transitioned that and heard about it. Yes, I remember people being surprised when some so-called colleagues of you were discussing your demise just after, the first week of 1981 on CBC. I remember listening to it. And,
it started on December the 31st of 1980.
What started?
The chatter of our demise.
Yes. But I heard these guys on CBC, and they said, I didn't know. I read his works, and I had no idea he was a Catholic. So that's the image you're saying. He was doing non-Catholic things by writing for Playboy and stooping to be interviewed and all that. That's a good example of his slackening. Now, some people might have thought, well, he was he knew not to mention his Catholicism in public, because it was an anti-Catholic, anti-religious period, the latter part of the 60s. It was the anarchy.
It didn't work out good for President Kennedy.
Right. So they thought that you were hiding it for strategic reasons to deal with the increasingly hedonistic secular society.
We were hiding it because it was obsolete.
Yeah, not because it was more serious than what you were doing in public. Because it was obsolete. Well, that's a new angle. And will any, will either Mark Stallman or Francesco Guardini come up with these kind of ideas tomorrow?
No, but they can nervously wash their hands to get the blood that just won't seem to go away for how they butchered our work over the years.
What, did you want your work to continue in some way, or is it going to be continued anyways by the next manipian of the tradition, what you guys call the tradition?
Well, we have great strides. We have great confidence in this knee-jerk reaction, reactionary person called Bob Dobbs.
Ah, yes.
He's quite the provocateur. And
yes.
we're not sure we can trust his motives because they're pronounced. That's the problem with his motives, is they're pronounced. We know what the motives are, so that would somehow give you cause to be taken aback. But we'll have to play with it because we'll see if this all works out. If he can dead the mechanical bride, he most certainly can taint the Gutenberg galaxy.
So. Do you recognize some of my strategies or tactics in your own procedures, your own protocol?
Well, we'll leave that to Andrew Crystal now, won't we?
You have noticed, Andrew. That's wonderful.
Talk about cliched archetype. There you go.
Yes, okay. There's an interview by a British guy about 67 where you're quoted saying, I'm the only one who knows what's going on. Did you actually say that to him?
We did.
And what were you saying you were knowledgeable about that nobody else understood? Being an absurdist?
We know we don't know what's going on. Look at the word. I'm the only one that knows what's going on, that I have no knowing of that which is going on. I'm the only one who knows that nothing is going on. There is nothing going on.
And you knew it couldn't be understood?
Apparently.
Now, would you, where you are today, wherever that is, used to be called the Guff, but the Guff isn't there anymore, what's your strategy for your own... existence as the end times unfold amongst us in the next year.
Well, we're left with the only thing that ever really worked anyway. We're going to see how Bob works this out. If he pulls it off, it'll be the greatest story ever told. And if he does it, we'll become the thing we always were anyway, forgotten.
What was the last word? Zaki?
Forgotten.
What did you become?
Forgotten.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, Carolyn, it's moving into the inevitable narcissism of emphasizing me, so how do we get out of this and wrap it up by, what do you have a question?
You forgot to ask if you were responsible for keeping McLuhan from going forward through to non-Guffdom.
What? But that doesn't make any sense. Like,
Ion told you that you were holding...
Oh, McLuhan. That's right. Well, it sounds like just by what he said. Ion's... Yes, that's right. Back when people would transition and hope to get into the Goths and they had to judge themselves, that Ion told me, Marshall, that I was holding you back from entering the Goth because you wanted to see what I was doing or you were... trapped by me or held back, I'm not sure, and you just hinted at it. You just said it. You just said it, Carol. He said that he's sticking around to see how Bob does, and that's the reason you didn't go into the Guff, right, Marshall?
Especially since we were never baptized, so that's another thing that would hold us back a little bit.
Okay, so the... but, Carol, do you have a question as the... Young.
No, that was my question, and you missed it, and I said it.
But the question already been answered.
Asked and answered.
No, by him, before you asked it. No, I'm saying as a person.
No.
Look, ask Marshall what he makes of the world of medicine that you're engaging and what you plan to do with it.
No, I don't care.
She didn't care about you, Marshall. She had no interest in you.
Well, she's saying exactly right, because there is no world of medicine. There is no world of medicine. That's
right.
You put on wellness. You put on wellness, and you get up sick. If you don't put on wellness and wrap that in, then you're doomed to serve the devil that you bought.
Hey, interesting. Yeah, wonderful. What do you think, Carolyn? Have I done it? Have we explored enough?
For now.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I'd like more opportunity. But this is for now. We hope, Marshall, to have this posted before 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time in Toronto on Sunday, April 24th.
Where will you ever find a printing press that could pull that off, Bob? Where are you going to find a printing press to do that? Oh, Carolyn's got... Oh, no, that's right. Carolyn's got her mimeograph machine. That'll be fine. Make the master good, and make sure you use the good ink and not that cheap stuff you've been hiding back there. Use the good ink. It won't bleed.
Oh, I know something. Derek de Kerckhoff is hoping to become an advisor to the Vatican. Do you have any suggestions or advice for him?
I hear there are a lot of positions available.
At the Vatican.
He can virtually work from home. It'll be... that'll be great. Congratulations.
That's a good joke.
That
made you laugh. Made you laugh. But the, what was I saying? So, yes, so we can do this with some modern technologies you don't seem to be aware of. We can get that posted before the seminar starts, the salon starts on Sunday afternoon in Toronto.
Whoa. So, that'll be the salon, and what we just did then would be the representation of the saloon.
We're the saloon.
Uh-huh. Okay, good.
Something like that.
Well, good. Glad we got that cleaned up.
All right, so...
I want to congratulate you. Thank you for saving what's left of our meager, humble name.
And do you ever get a chance to talk to James Joyce over there?
Twice.
And what did you people share, you two?
That most of his machinations, however sound, were mostly drug-induced.
Cocaine.
Malcontented thesis.
Thesis? T-H-E-S-I-S?
Yes.
Thesis? Malcontent thesis. So, you were heavily involved studying the men of 1914, Lewis, Pound, Eliot, and Joyce, maybe a little Yeats. You met Lewis and Pound. Were they the ones of the four or five worth meeting more than Joyce and Eliot?
So far. We'll see how it goes.
Ah, have you talked to Eliot?
Sure.
All right. What do they make of what you did with their work?
They don't recognize we did anything.
And we should end on that point. That's a wonderful point to end on. Well, it's been wonderful talking.
He fell off the bus, y'all.
Okay, we're back.
Yeah, you didn't ask what McLuhan thinks of you owning his name.
Well, we don't talk about that yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's easy. The last thing Marshall said was thank you for protecting my name, his name.
That's right. Before Calum accidentally flipped the phone off. Yeah. Okay. So I was thanking Marshall and then thanking you, Ion, and the tech body for a wonderful exchange in the spirit of the Monday night seminars, I think. Or the Saturday Night Saloon?
All right.
Thank you very much.
Y'all come back. It's the Y'all Come Back Saloon.
I think we'll end with that.